Hello, everyone. Welcome to our final episode of season two of Coffee Chats with Researchers. I am thrilled you're here. Thank you for taking this journey with us. Today, for this last conversation, I'm speaking with Dr. Rebecca Campbell, who comes to us from Michigan State. As you might know, in the last episode, we spoke to someone from the University of Michigan, Dr. April Zioli. So I wanted to just line them all up. Everybody from Michigan just here representing. But wrapping up with this conversation feels really important to the season. Dr. Campbell is an incredible researcher, a just valuable asset, and excellent at presenting her scholarship, her research, and why this work matters. So listen to our conversation where we really talk about serving survivors at the university level and how we can help institutions better understand violence prevention, and specifically really the impacts of what it means to experience gender-based violence and violence overall, and how universities really need to be responsive in both their actions, their structures, like their services, but also their policies and how they can support survivors. So enjoy our conversation. Thank you again for being a part of the second season and for your continued support. Thank you so much, Dr. Campbell, for being here. I like to start all the episodes. If you could give me an overview of you and just hear a little bit about who I'm talking to today.
Sure. My name is Rebecca Campbell. I use she, her pronouns. I have two jobs right now at Michigan State University, one of which is a professor of psychology, where I study sexual violence and focus on victims' disclosure and help-seeking experiences with formal systems and informal support providers. And my other job is to serve as an advisor on relationship violence and sexual misconduct to the president of Michigan State University, and to focus our campus efforts on improving services for survivors and strengthening our prevention programming.
Amazing. So when you talk about help seeking, I think for those folks who aren't in the field or aren't regularly in the research, can you talk a bit about what you're considering when you're doing research around help seeking and why understanding that pathway is important?
Sure. I think it's important to focus on this issue because sexual assault, which is the particular form of gender-based violence that I study, has really devastating impacts on survivors' health and well-being in so many different domains, emotionally, physical health, school, work, so many areas of their lives. And it's a heavy burden to carry by themselves. It's a very, very heavy burden to carry by themselves. And there are so many resources and supports that are available that might be able to help them. But survivors very understandably have a lot of reticence to reach out and to disclose to anybody. And I think that that has become harder and harder over the years. So I think there's just sort of fundamental irony in my work that's hard sometimes to reconcile, is that at a time where we have more and more services, survivors are very reasonably more and more reluctant to come forward. And I think that the reasons for those reluctances are important to understand. So I want to understand from survivors' point of view, what was their decision-making process? Was it even a decision-making process? Did they kind of blurt out a disclosure to somebody close to them? And that person may have been a mandatory reporter. This happens a lot on college campuses, where the disclosure, when heard by someone else, is like, oh my goodness, I need to report that to the university. And the survivor's like, whoa, that's not what I was interested in. So sometimes the pathway into disclosure and help seeking is not exactly what the survivor wants. And I think it's important to understand why that happens, how that happens, and what we can do to make help seeking a more volitional process for survivors and a more empowering process for survivors. And I think some survivors are aware of services and may not want to reach out to them. And I think there's very valid reasons for that, particularly among marginalized, minoritized communities. You know, there's valid questions, the extent to which different services, the legal system, the medical system, victim advocacy organizations, are they prepared truly to serve, for example, members of the LGBTQIA plus community? Do they have cultural competence to work with folks of different races, ethnicities, and cultural backgrounds? Maybe, maybe not. So I think that there's some very good reasons why survivors may not do that. And it's a tremendous leap of faith when they do. So I want to understand sort of, again, what makes them decide to come forward and what are those experiences like for them? And what can we do on the service side to make those experiences easier for outreach, easier to travel, and more responsive to what it is survivors actually need and want?
You mentioned in there about survivors might not want or find it helpful to follow maybe a help-seeking process as it's initially laid out. Can you speak a bit to what you'd want to see happen when a provider or a support person runs into that barrier with a survivor and sort of why it's important to honor that reality for them?
Sure. I think that one of the most salient examples of that is in the health domain. And since the 1980s, we've had this standing recommendation that victims ought to receive a medical forensic exam and the collection of a rape kit, or what they're now called sexual assault kit. And the whole idea and history of these kits was is that this forensic evidence that's on the survivor's body could be collected by a healthcare practitioner, doctor, nurse, typically in an emergency department setting. And this evidence would somehow, be the magic thing that would finally prompt the criminal legal system to take these cases seriously, investigate them, prosecute them, and there would be all this wonderful evidence that they could use. You know, a story for another interview, that isn't exactly what happens. That is definitely not what happens in most cases. But the whole sort of issue got kind of all snarled up in healthcare and legal and what does the survivor actually wants? So some may have very, very strong concerns about, for example, the risk of pregnancy after an assault or the risk of a sexually transmitted infection. And what's really on their mind is not having a head-to-toe examination and forensic evidence collected, but I need the emergency contraception. I need plan B. And the assailant didn't use a condom. And I'm really worried about HIV or other sexually transmitted infections. And I want to get this exam, the medical part of it, so that I can take care of my health and no thank you on the kit. And actually our research team, you know, did a paper recently, essentially what we affectionately called our no thank you paper, the right to say no. And for sane sexual assault nurse examiner practitioners to respect that choice, to just give survivors what they want. And we are starting to see that more and more in those specialized healthcare programs, which are often called sexual assault nurse examiner programs, where in those programs, nurses are more likely to sort of present a menu of options to survivors. If you want this, you can do this. If you want this, you can do this. And what we're also starting to see in a relatively small number of jurisdictions is more options on that forensic evidence collection piece to collect it, but not have it submitted for a lab for testing. Just collect and hold. Let me get my bearings. I was here for emergency contraception. I wasn't here to make a report to the police. You can have the evidence collected, let it set, and let that be an informed decision over time. That's the kind of help seeking experiences I would like service providers to offer survivors, is to say, you don't have to make huge decisions right now. What's most important to you right now? Let's address those. Are there time-sensitive things that we might want to do now just to have done, like evidence collection, but you don't have to make a decision about it now? We can leave options open. And I think that's what it's really about. It's leaving options open for survivors for what they need when they need it.
What do you see as the main or maybe biggest barriers to that process being widespread or implemented among providers? Because it seems certainly that the knowledge or the research is kind of catching up a lot more to that idea, maybe, or I think service providers know that that's true. It seems hard from a systems perspective to see that change be possible.
I think there's a couple of reasons why this is challenging. And one is kind of a big picture, fundamental problem, fundamental shift that still needs to happen. And it's for practitioners to fully understand and embrace and not say this with lip service, but to really mean it and live it. Survivors are the experts of their lives. It's a phrase that you sometimes hear in conferences and papers, and it's sort of used a lot. And what that really means is that if you say that, you have to believe it, you have to mean it, and you have to walk the walk and talk the talk, which means that if the survivor says, I don't want this or I do want that, that is what the practitioner needs to do. So I think that there's still some maternalism in practitioners of what they think is best for survivors, or what survivors ought to do, or what is the right thing to do. Or over an accumulation of many, many years as a practitioner, you start to feel like, ooh, I've seen this before and I know what the right thing to do is, and I know that they might regret this later on. So I need to do this, that, or the other. And those are hard feelings to have, I think, as a practitioner, to feel like you know what's coming and you may not be able to convince somebody in the here and now of a decision that might make something else possible or not possible later on. But if we are really there for survivors, and if we are really going to believe and live this value that they are the experts of their own lives, we need to take what they say as real, as true, as their truth, and act accordingly. So I think that's one reason. I think the other reason is system bureaucracy. There's a way things are done. There's policies, procedures, and checklists. And once you're on the conveyor belt, people are like, well, this is the conveyor belt. And you need to do the kit. You need to do the police report. You know, this idea that there is a way to do this. So again, I think there's another piece there that's both sort of bureaucracy, but also mind shifting of there's not a way. There's as many different help seeking journeys as there are survivors. And it's not our position as scientists or as practitioners to tell somebody what their journey is. Our job is to support them in that journey.
That's so beautifully put and so clear, which I think can be hard sometimes to articulate, that it actually is okay to step out of that bureaucracy because we are so rooted in having an exact way.
Mm-hmm.
And for reasons that are rooted in efficiency and the systems that they are originally based in, like you're saying, you know, like healthcare systems and legal systems.
So many of those systems are really designed from the service provider's point of view.
Exactly.
You know, and we use this term survivor-centered, victim-centered. And, you know, again, it's one of those things of that's the words. What's the meaning of those words? And are we living the meaning of those words? And you look at in college campuses, the Title IX reporting process, a hospital emergency department for medical care, or reporting to law enforcement, or even sometimes the process of seeking mental health counseling. And you sort of look at that and you're like, there is no way this was designed with survivors in mind. This was designed with systems in mind in terms of what their normal policies and procedures are, what their medical record system says, what their funders require. So what I'd really love to see is more of that shift to really thinking through what do we mean when we say survivor-centered, center it, and make sure that the pathways for help are really written, designed, and focused on what survivors need and what's helpful to them and what is not helpful to them.
Absolutely. I'm going to backtrack to learn a bit more about what brought you here as a psychologist and now as a researcher, professor, and as you mentioned, an advisor, sort of in a higher level administrative position. What kind of got you into this work and what led you to where you are today?
So what got me into this work is actually kind of a fairly common pathway. I was in college. I was an undergrad. I was taking a women's gender studies class. We needed to do a community engagement, community practicum, service learning type thing. And, you know, here's a list of agencies. Volunteered at an agency in the town where I went to college. It was a combined domestic violence shelter and rape crisis program, which was pretty common back in the 1980s to have those two blended together. And I went through volunteer training. And it was, I remember it, it was in the basement of the Unitarian Church in town and had this very subversive, you know, counter-revolutionary, smash the patriarchy kind of vibe in the basement. And I really loved it. And what we were training to do was to be victim advocates. And so to work with victims in court or in the medical system. Now, 30 plus years later, I look back at that and sort of say, wow, what I was really learning wasn't really smashing the patriarchy. What I was really learning was how to enact a system that was designed by the system, well-intentioned and advocates at that time, you know, well-intentioned, again, to try to help get survivors what they need, particularly still with this very legal focused lens in it. So I, you know, very dutifully went to the hospital emergency departments. Back in those days, we carried a pager. The survivor presented, the pager went off. You went to the hospital emergency department, and it is what survivors go through in hospital emergency departments. It still is. What I saw as a victim advocate in the late 80s, I'm quite sure is happening somewhere in the United States right now in 2022. I have no doubt of a hospital emergency department resident who has very little training in sexual assault, nothing in trauma-informed care. It's never done a rape exam and pulls open the kit and opens up the directions. And that's her first time doing this. And I saw that and I thought, this is insane. This cannot be what we ask survivors to do. And I could hold their hands. I could advocate on their behalf. I could give constructive and sometimes less constructive feedback to medical personnel about what they were doing. but I wasn't fundamentally changing any of this. So I went to graduate school with that idea of, I want to do research on how to improve help seeking. And that's sort of been where I've been at ever since and still am at. But over time, it's become a little bit more complicated than trying to think through what help seeking is, should be, could look like. But I was still very passionate about this needs to be empowering. This needs to be helpful. And I became very interested in sexual assault nurse examiner programs and what it looks like when that care is in the hands of the nursing profession, which tends to be a much more patient-centered discipline, and found that it can be incredibly transformative for survivors, that the care that they receive in those programs can be very life-changing and can feel very healing. Sometimes it doesn't. Not all programs are the same. And sometimes it's just better, faster evidence collection. So it's still pretty mixed. And over time, I became sort of more involved in these sort of legal and medical spaces. And then as more and more jurisdictions started realizing that all of these kits that the nurses had been collecting or the doctors had been collecting weren't being tested. You know, the whole idea was is that there was evidence, we're going to test this, it's somehow mystically, magically going to result in fixing this under prosecution of sexual assault that's been going on since the dawn of time. Well, it didn't. They were putting these kits in storage untested. So for the past 10 years, I've been working a lot on this issue of untested rape kits, trying to understand, why did this happen? What were the individual factors, the organizational factors, the cultural factors that led to this? You know, was this evidence still viable? Do survivors want it tested now? Do they want to re-engage? And so I've worked with a couple of communities very, very closely as they've been resolving this issue. And along the way, kind of got more and more entrenched in working with communities that had large-scale catastrophic failures in their response to sexual assault and in their help-seeking services. And then when my own institution, Michigan State University, had a large-scale institutional failure in our response to the former Dr. Larry Nassar and his abuse of patients through MSU clinics and elsewhere, I had the opportunity with many changes in administration to be brought in to the administrative circle to say, you seem to know a lot about these, you know, failures. How do we do this differently? How do we rebuild? How do we make this a better process for survivors?
Yeah,
so started in college campus, kind of ending, you know, or at the currently in college campus settings too.
Yeah, so I think that's a really wonderful transition to speak to what you have in the works now, both on a research end, but also where you're focusing your energies and your attention and what your career has offered, you know, in terms of your learning, your education, your understanding, and how you go about addressing what you see as this next level of work in the field.
Yeah, and for me, being trained as a community psychologist, we focus on community level phenomena. We don't believe the answers within the individual victim. The answers are in the systems in the communities. And we have an obligation as scientists to be scholar activists, to take what we learn from our research and use it to not just publish it in a journal. That's nice. Great. You've talked to, you know, a small audience, a small, highly educated audience, and that can be very important. And it is very important. I'm not discounting the work of science purely, but I envision a different model of science. I envision a model of science that has multiple methods of dissemination and that we are really well suited to be involved in policy and practice. We've done the research. We know this very, very well. We can and should be in policy and practice arenas, ensuring that our work does change and influence practice. We need to be translational scholars, activist scholars.
I guess a similar question, what do you see as the barriers to a more connected approach, especially in social science research and social service research?
I think there's a couple of barriers that have to be addressed, and I think they're all addressable. I think about how we train in graduate school, and we train people, and I include myself in that, we, at least for how I train graduate students. And early in my career, I don't do this as much anymore. But even in like foundational first year, you know, graduate courses, master's or PhD levels, how do we train students to come up with a research question? We teach them to go read the academic literature.
Okay.
And we teach them to find a gap, and we teach them to define a question around the gap, and then hopefully to make some sort of assertion on the importance of filling that gap and addressing that gap. And what that process does is it centers the informational needs of the scientific community. We reference ourselves, the scientific community, by studying and analyzing our own work, finding out what other people haven't done. And then we focus the informational need on making more of this, making a more complete scientific record. And so we train generation after generation after generation of scholars to think about from the most fundamental piece of what they want to do in answering the informational needs of a complete scientific record as opposed to what a policy or practitioner might need. So I think we need to kind of shift this and shift how we train future generations and untrain ourselves for all of us who learned in that same tradition to say that the research question actually comes from policies and practitioners, that the research questions come from the community. The research questions come from survivors. And I have sort of a standing joke with many of my grad students, you know, you're on the right track when you are struggling to write your lit review because there's no literature, which is from an academic point of view, a total pain.
Totally not right.
It's really hard. Nobody likes to do that. When you're in that, absolutely. You're like, oh my gosh, how am I ever going to get in front of a committee? How am I going to get this grant funded? How am I going to, you know, get this paper published? But I think it's a sign that you're in the right direction and that you might be able to weave together different literature, different ideas, sensitizing concepts, key things to sort of make a landing pad to say, I am aware of prior research and I can use that to springboard into this new area that really addresses and centers the informational needs of survivors, the informational needs of those who support them, and those needs of the policymakers. That's the way
right.
We should be doing research. And I think the other barriers are sort of ones that we talk a lot about. And I think slowly academia is changing, which is there's no or very little institutional reward. At the end of the day, you know, it's how many widgets did you make? And the widgets are journal articles and publications and things like that. And there's no great way to measure the widget of, you know, I had this really, really great discussion with a policymaker and this is going to happen or whatnot. So I think we do see academia starting to shift a bit and thinking about ways of capturing that outreach and engagement and thinking about it as part of promotion, tenure decisions, annual reviews, salary, and the like. And I think once that becomes more institutionalized in academia, a big barrier will come down. And I think the extent to which grant funders sort of expect that and build that into their expectations for grants, it's like, not just this, but this kind of engagement is what we expect. When it becomes codified, institutionalized, and expected and rewarded is when you usually see behavioral shifts.
Yeah, I think our funding for this work and this project in particular was a huge demonstration of that with a larger funding stream that required part of that to include how are we sharing this beyond a paper?
Exactly.
And that is happening oftentimes in smaller arenas, but to have it on a federal level was a big game changer for what has now become a pretty institutional process for us as a research center. And we see that even trickling into our School of Social Work. So of course, that's based on what I see as what's happening. But I do think others would agree that that has been the ripple of having funding in this way that has allowed for that to be an institutional process that now will continue and will be an expectation. We do need to continue to figure out the funding and the recognition and the institutional acknowledgement that it is something that should be fiscally supported.
Yes.
But that the reality is that the landing pad for advocating for that is here because we've been doing it now with external grant funding for a number of years. And so to see it go away would be a large impact that no one wants to sort of see happen. So exactly. I think that's such a good point in this process. I've been able to kind of demonstrate that that is true around if we can see larger institutional engagement and investment in the work, we can see a broader reach, which ultimately, right, when you're talking about how many widgets and where things count in the larger academic arena, when we're prioritizing papers, and this is an obvious thing, but I think it sort of feels like an important reminder is like academic literature is off limits for most folks.
Right.
It is not accessible and not even into a larger community, but in a, you cannot access most journals without
literally
either university access or you're paying. And so it's almost when you say it out loud and you kind of walk through that chain of events, it feels baffling that we're not more adverse to it as a process.
Right, exactly. And even as the open science trend seeks to remedy that problem and make science more accessible, most journals charge a pretty staggering open science fee. And those of us who do gender-based violence research often aren't rolling around in very large grants to be able to pay for these degrees. And then you put it out of pocket. So again, these are really significant and absolutely solvable barriers that would get the research more accessible. But then again, it's not just accessibility, it's also translation and engagement with the research.
Absolutely. So next steps in the work and what you see as priority areas, where would you want to see research heading? We've touched on some of it, but I think more pointedly to hear from your perspective, where do you see as the largest areas for that attention, for funding, for institutions to pay better attention to?
With all due respect to social epidemiologists and the need for prevalence and incidence studies, they're pretty stable over time. And I feel like it's a trap in terms of continuing to argue the ubiquitousness of this and to drill down to the precise measurement. And again, that feels very strange for me to say as a methodologist, as a social scientist, but I don't think that's really the issue or the extent to which we're going to be focusing on prevalence and incidence. I would really like to see centering some of the populations that have not been well assessed. We know from current assessments that Native and Indigenous women are at disproportionate risk. I would like to understand the prevalence and incidence of that more deeply. And in other marginalized and minoritized communities, we know that members of the LGBTQIA plus have higher rates. I'd like to learn more about that. So I would like to see some of the populations that do have higher incidence rates studied more closely in collaboration with those to get better understanding of prevalence and incidence in those communities. But other than that, I would love us to move toward truly understanding survivor-centered care and to understand what services survivors want and how we provide them, and to make the help-seeking process as simple and easy and trauma-informed and helpful. What a concept, helpful to survivors as possible. And for that to happen, we really do have to make that shift of understanding and honoring and valuing that survivors are the experts of their own experiences. And I've been in too many spaces over my career where survivors have been invited to the table and have expressed their ideas and essentially have been told, that's not possible. We can't do that. Or the implication is that's naive. That is very individualistic. That would work for you. That's your individual experience, but we can't take that to scale. And I've argued in those spaces, I don't think that's true. I think we can take things to scale. I think we can make pathways that are helpful to survivors. And I'd really like to see more focused on that. I would like to understand more about how large-scale institutions can shift their programming, their policies, their mindset, their organizational mindset to care about these issues and to put organizational time and attention into this. There's a lot of emphasis on, you know, we need to believe survivors. And I agree that we need to believe survivors, but I also sometimes feel like that's kind of a trap too, that we get kind of caught up in the credibility arguments. And there's different ways people come to believing. One way they come to believing survivors and caring about this is because their organization, their job dictates certain behaviors. They have to do the investigation. They have to do these different things. And then lo and behold, they sort of come to realize, oh my gosh, this is true. So I think there's different pathways to creating the culture change. And I would like to see more creativity about that other than the sort of idea that we need this fundamental belief of survivors. I agree. And we've been saying that for decades, and that doesn't seem to help people believe. So what are the other strategies we could be using? I believe it's important that we think about and get creative with our prevention. I handle more on the response side. So I defer to all my colleagues who are prevention scientists to know what the right next steps are in there. That's not my life's work. My life's work is on the response side.
You have, at least in my conversations, a pretty unique experience in terms of being at a larger institution that is needing to address and, you know, I guess be held accountable for having such a public incident or a series of incidents come to light. Can you speak to what has been your largest takeaway as a scholar and a person who is being asked to kind of give guidance on what I imagine was not something you maybe expected to be in the position of giving that advice and guidance and perspective on?
I've learned many things and I'm learning many things. So I'm still at the place of experiencing and not quite on the other side of reflecting and knowing what I've learned. But what I've learned so far is that it is much harder than one might expect to try to get large-scale institutions to do the most basic things to stop hurting survivors. It is sometimes a very hard space to be in when I'm with my researchers and with survivor advocates who have ideas, valid ideas, creative ideas, interesting ideas about how things ought to be. And the bureaucratic slog of trying to get a large institution to stop doing things that hurt and to start moving them into new directions. Educations of higher learning are very slow. They're very bureaucratic. There's interesting scholarship on the fact that they are designed to be slow, steady, unchanging. They're not nimble. They're not quick. They're not great in a crisis, as it turns out. And trying to get them to really unlearn and relearn, again, it's just another irony that I have to live in of, wait a minute, we're an institution of higher learning. We should be able to unlearn and relearn. Thank you very much. And it is hard. It is really hard to do that. So that has been a very frustrating and humbling experience to have ideas about transformational change and wanting to do transformational change and sometimes just not being able to get the pieces and parts of the institution to move in the way that I need them to try it. Or there's outside forces like Title IX. You know, what the Title IX regs are and that they change by administration and different administrations put different folks foci on different aspects of this. And that feels like a wall you keep bumping up against. And then you're thinking, okay, well, there's other options. You know, I'm very excited about what I see in some communities of color around transformative justice and restorative justice. And I think those models have a lot of promise and could have a lot of promise in institutions of higher learning. And I'm not sure how to translate them. I'm not sure that I'm the right person to translate them. And sometimes the best that I can do is to clear space for other people to think and do the radical thinking and creating work that might make those models possible somewhere down the road. So it is humbling trying to change a large scale institution. It is humbling to do that after such profound institutional betrayal and when trust is so low.
Thank you for being willing to share that. It's such an important reflection and learning and the greater understanding for really what the limitations are of the systems that we are working and living in. And that as individuals, we may want something different. And yet when we're in a structure, it becomes next to impossible as an individual, even when we want to be different or see ourselves differently, that structure ultimately plays out as it is designed. And
people are like, oh, the system's acting exactly as it's supposed to. It's functioning just fine. The system's designed to continue power and privilege. They're doing just fine, sweetie. The issue is trying to dismantle them. They can be changed. I don't know that they can be dismantled, but I know they can be changed. But it takes time. And I think that's another piece where systems of oppression have all of the time on their side. And we don't. We have individual lifetimes. We have individual careers. We have individual moments. So it can be done, but it takes time. The community that I worked with around their untested rape kits have done, I think, really amazing work in that space. That was 10 years. I was involved in that project for 10 years. And I see that over the course of the life of my children, of the age that they were when we started. One of them was 6 and, you know, is 16 now. The work that I do with Michigan State, I started in 2018 at the rupture of our institutional crisis around the Nassar case. And it's 2022 and I'm still there. So it takes time. And the system is really built on you losing your patience. and getting frustrated and disengaging. So part of it is like, I'm a patient person. I'm going to outlast you.
Well, thank you for your patience.
I won't outlast.
Sure.
But yeah. I try my best, bring up new generations of scholars, and together we can outlast them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The patience is enough to develop what will come next, and exactly. The patience enough to not walk away maybe too soon, you right. know. I like to end with a question that I think you might have gotten to a bit already, but if you were to be given a unrestricted pot of money to do a research project or to look at something or offer maybe a program or service that was in your space or your body of work but didn't have the qualifications needed or extra deliverables, where would you put that energy and that money?
Easy. I would serve as a pass-through to the people working on transformative justice models. Again, many of them are in communities of color, other marginalized, minoritized communities, and really thinking about what does accountability look like in the community and making the power for accountability in the community, not in these systems like the legal system, which is really so inherently laden with racism, classism, sexism, heterosexism, and all different forms of isms, that what it would look like to provide accountability and healing and closure and justice outside of that system. And I wouldn't want to keep the money for myself because I know that that's not my area of expertise, but I would love to give it to the community organizers working in that space. And I would love to work with them as a consultant on some type of interesting empowerment evaluation or emancipatory or participatory evaluation project to understand how that model works, how it comes to be, and what kind of impact it has on people who work in transformative justice spaces and survivors who experience transformative justice interventions. That's what I would do.
You had that ready. You were.
I did. Well, I think about it. It's knowing when to pass the mic and when.
Yeah.
The resources and the stage to other people, and understanding your strengths and limitations and understanding where you can help. And I think my skills as a methodologist, particularly in diverse methodologies, could be helpful in those spaces. And that is something I'm excited about.
Amazing. Well, part of the hope is also that if we speak these things out, maybe they will come to fruition. So
I love that.
Good to say into the universe. So thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure. I would love maybe at some point in the future to connect again and just continue to hear about your work. It is truly impactful, and it's really nice to be able to hear from your perspective and as someone who has been in the field for a bit and is training kind of that next generation as well, to hear your innovative perspectives and just what you're hoping for the future. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for chatting with me about all of these ideas.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers.